Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thank you, one and all, for being with us whenever it is in your week that you listen. I'm always fascinated to think about the people all over the world that are listening at all different times and the people that are listening to us now while we do this live. My guest tonight is Jerry Mills, who is a physician, a veterinarian, and an amazing energy healing practitioner. And it's going to be a fun conversation tonight. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And, you know, I'm the guy that always talks about walkabout, and I'm just sitting here laughing about what's going on in my life and my daughter's life. My daughter leaves for the first of two jobs that she's doing for the summer. She's going back to the camp where she went for years. That's an internationally known performing arts camp, where she was studying dance and having fun at camp. And she's going to be a nanny for some of the staff people and get to hang out with her friends. So, of course, total chaos ensued because she had to get all of her stuff ready. And to make it crazier, I'm moving before she comes back from camp. So she was moving stuff out of her room here and arranging things and telling me what to do with all kinds of different stuff. And of course, it's Mercury retrograde, which is our favorite scapegoat for everything that goes wrong. So all kinds of little glitches were happening. And I'm very excited that, well, for those of you that have been following David's adventures and my whiny story about the craziness with the students that surround my present apartment, I just found an apartment where I am going to be basically out in the middle of an open field in a 200-something-year-old house. I have the whole second floor with a huge screen porch, so I'll be living and working out on the porch probably any time that it's warm enough to do that. And instead of having students cavorting and having loud parties and being obnoxious, the worst thing that will probably be going on is hearing the coyotes at night. So I'm excited. It's going to be great fun. But I've got a month to pack everything up and get myself out of here and over to the other place. And it reminds me of a wonderful routine that George Carlin did about your stuff. Because, you know, if you want to feel comfortable in your life, you have to have your stuff, whatever it is that you take with you to make you feel comfortable and feel like you've got what you need. And if you go on vacation, you have to take a smaller version of your stuff. And then if you're on vacation and you meet somebody and they say, oh, come on over to the other side of the island and stay overnight with us, then you have to take an even smaller version of your stuff. And that's certainly what it feels like when, you know, I've been in this apartment for 10 years and I've got to figure out which of the stuff is my stuff and get rid of the stuff that's no longer really my stuff and move it all into a new place and find where it belongs in this new space. Somebody, I wish I could tell you what brilliant and incredible spiritual master said this, but somebody said, if you want to grow spiritually, clean out your closets. So here I am right in the middle of that. And of course, the first stage in doing any of those things is procrastination. And I'm doing that really, really well today. So I hope you will all send me good wishes and and moving boxes and plastic crates and packing tape and people to help. And yeah, need all of that stuff. It'll all work out. Sell the air conditioners, buy a washer and dryer, you know. The adventure of moving to a new place and to a new stage of life and a whole new adventure being closer to a different town and all of that. So David's on walkabout. David's daughter is on walkabout, and probably you are on walkabout, whether you realize it or not, and life is good. So thanks for listening to this metaphysical musing, or rant, whichever it was, and let's talk to our wonderful guest, Dr. Jerry Mills. Thanks so much for being on the show, Jerry.
Thanks for having me, David.
And I want you to know that everybody that I know online has been sending me emails and Facebook messages saying, Jerry's really good.
Uh-oh.
You got a good one this time. Like, I didn't know that, but I thought it was really adorable. So you have an incredible combination of, first of all, degrees, that you are both a medical doctor and a veterinarian. I have never heard of anyone else that's done that. And you add to that your skills as an energy healer. So I want to hear more about your work. And I also want to hear about how you wind up. What was your walkabout? What was your journey to doing what you do now?
Well, David, I grew up in the most unspiritual family that could walk the face of this planet. And then I went to boarding school in Sedona. And you didn't have to believe or not believe about spirits. You just saw them. This is 45 years ago when Sedona was magic and there were very few buildings. My school was 13 miles from the next set of buildings, really.
Huh.
And the second thing that really shaped me during that year is that my boyfriend in high school introduced me to science fiction and fantasy novels.
Uh-huh.
And then as the years went on, that continued to be my great escape. So through veterinary school and then a few years later through medical school and residency, whenever I needed to get away from the craziness of Western medicine and the stresses of my life, I escaped to Marion Zimmer Bradley and Anne McCaffrey, where a lot of their fantasy worlds were sort of futuristic versions of ancient Celtic society where people healed with their hands and there was real magic. And I thought it was just a fantasy world. And the more time I spent in Western medicine, the more frustrated I became with that at the same time, David. Because while we're fabulous at fixing somebody when they get hit by a truck, Western mm-hmm. medicine doesn't do a whole heck of a lot for chronic diseases besides give a name to the incurable condition, usually at great expense and frequently with invasive procedures.
Right.
But I still thought it was just fantasy. And then back in 91, I moved to Tucson. I learned to meditate. I read some books that really moved me, but I still didn't expect any of this stuff to come into my life. So I'm meditating every day before going into either the hospital or into my office. And I did a little meditation from Shakti Gawain's creative visualization, only I put my own twist on it. And I would imagine inhaling green healing energy from the center of the planet, feel it swirling through my body, and then imagine that it went out the top of my head into the universe. And then after a few minutes, I would inhale pink creative energies from the universe, feel them swirling through my head and shoulders and through my body and finally going out through my feet into the center of the earth. And I did this to ground myself before going into work. So basically, it didn't have a way of being any more than that at the time. And one day I took a creativity workshop at the community college in Tucson. It was taught by a woman named Diane Ely, who has a PhD in creativity. And as a by the way, in the middle of one of the days of class, she happened to mention that she can heal people with her hands. Well, David, my heart lit up. You know, this was an educated, bright woman who said she could do what I had been dreaming about and reading about my whole life. It wasn't some slightly stoned, very strange person on the corner in the French Quarter in New Orleans. So we arranged to have lunch together a few days later, and while we were sitting and chatting, I said, so tell me about this energy healing. And she goes, oh, well, I just breathe healing energy from the universe into my heart and exhale it out of my hands. And then she gave a whole bunch of examples of how she used energy healing to save dive trips. But I was just, God, I was so excited. It was like this stuff was finally real. And I said, Diane, can you teach me? And she said, sure. And then she didn't. So one day, but now I believed it was possible. And what has become ultimately a repetitive theme all through the next 20 years of my life and my journey as a healer is that when I believe something can happen, I can do it. So mm-hmm. was a couple weeks later, I was on labor and delivery at University Medical Center, and I belonged to a big group from an HMO, and the first patient I had to take care of was a little 15-year-old girl in labor. She was absolutely hysterical. She was curled up in the back of the bed with her arms wrapped around herself like a frightened little animal trying to stay safe, and then every time she had a contraction, she was practically hanging from the fixture in the ceiling. And her only support system was her little boyfriend, who didn't have a hair on his chin, looked like he was 12 years old and was more frightened than she was. And the only English she knew was, I want an epidural, which isn't possible when you can't hold still. And my Spanish was mostly take a deep breath, close your mouth, and push. So we didn't have a lot of communication, but I had to do something for this kid. So I did what I always do when a patient's frightened. I held her hand, and with gestures, I started teaching her how to do Lamaze breathing, which is the same kind of breathing that we do in meditation. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons physiologically that works is that when you take deep, slow breaths in through your abdomen, it actually shifts the predominant neurologic functions in your body to your parasympathetic nervous system, which is the part of the nervous system that would be active in a deer when she's out in the middle of a field grazing and feels completely safe. So anyhow, I hold this kid's hand. We take slow, deep breaths. And then without any intent on my part, I just sort of floated into the meditation that I normally do in the morning, only it was different. Instead of having the energy go out the top of my head or out through my feet, I could feel it all collecting in my heart as I inhaled. And as I exhaled, I could feel this sort of tingling sensation going down my arm and from my hand into the hand of this little girl. And within minutes, she had gone from hysterical and terrified to the poster child for Lamaze. Mm-hmm. So as she elegantly breathed through her contractions, we were able to get her settled in a more comfortable room and ultimately get the epidural that she wanted. And she had a beautiful delivery. So the next day, I called Diane on the phone. I said, Diane, I told her what happened. I said, I think I was channeling energy. She said, well, of course you were. Now you don't need me to teach you. Just keep doing it. So that was kind of how things got started for me, David.
I'm just laughing because I've had teachers like that. Oh, don't you understand that you can do this? I mean, what do you need me for now?
Yeah. Well, mostly she was right. And I started mm-hmm. consciously channeling energy when people were upset. And when I did it, I would hold their hand and they would hang on to me. And I knew that there needed to be some kind of permission, but I was working for the most conservative HMO in the area, in the most conservative hospital in Tucson, Arizona. This was back in 1993. So I wasn't ready to come out of the closet because I thought they'd fire me, and I had a lot of dogs and cats who really wanted to have their dinner every day. So I made this little deal with Spirit that I would hold people's hands and channel the energy, and if they wanted me to do it, they'd hold on, and if they didn't, they'd let go, and I'd just back off respectfully. Well, not only did they hold on like I was a life raft, but if I got paged and had to go out in the hall to answer a phone call or in the next room to check on another patient, they'd send their partner out for me, and I'd hear over and over again, Dr. Mills, I don't know why, but she'd really like you back in the room. She says she just feels better when you're in there with her. Can you come back in?
Mm-hmm.
So it was obvious that people were doing better. And, you know, eventually, spirit always sets up a situation when you got to come out of the closet. And that happened for me one morning, probably 6 months after I had started doing this work. And a little 16-year-old girl had been admitted the night before by one of my partners. She'd been laboring all night. Now, unlike the first little girl I told you about, Maria was a really bright, spiritual young woman. She and her aunt and her mother, who were her support system, had gone through Lamaze. And I walk in, and there's Native American flute music playing in the room. And she's trying to breathe through her contractions, but it got to the point where she was just losing it. She had been, as I said, contracting every 3 minutes since the night before. So the first thing I did after introducing myself and spending a few minutes with them was to examine this girl. And what I discovered was that after contracting all night, she was no farther dilated than she had been when my partner admitted her the night before. It was 8 in the morning when I saw her. She'd been there for about 8 hours. And the baby was enormous. Its head was so big, it was floating above her pelvis. I thought, oh, crap, she's going to need a C-section. But despite what they say about Western medical doctors, we don't just sharpen our knives. So sometimes when people don't progress in labor, it's because the contractions aren't strong enough or simply because they can't relax enough. So I explained this to Maria and her family, suggested that we might want to use some Pitocin, which is a medicine to make her contractions a little stronger and more regular. But I told her that I thought we should give her an epidural first because she was already having a hard time coping and the pain was going to get worse. Well, she started crying in earnest then, and she looked at me and she said, you know, I've planned on having natural childbirth and I'm not willing to have any drugs and I'm not willing to have you intervene. I'm going to have my baby. Well, at that point, Western medicine left me nothing to offer. And as spirit would have it, the nurse in the room with Maria that day was one of my closest friends, and she knew that I'd been doing energy healing. So I looked at Maria and I said, well, I do this thing called, and at that point, I had already learned Reiki on top of whatever I was doing spontaneously. Mm-hmm. I said, I do this thing called Reiki. It's an ancient healing art. It will allow me to channel healing energy from the universe through my body and out of my hands. And it might make you relax and might make your labor more a little bit easier. And her face just lit up and she said, oh, yes, my grandma had the healing touch. Please do this for me. So for the first time, I openly did a Reiki treatment on labor and delivery at University Medical Center. And she was holding her aunt and her mother's hands, but she was writhing around in the bed every time there was a contraction. And then I put my hands to her head, and the energy started to flow. And within minutes, her body just seemed to sort of melt into the pillows, and she relaxed, and she began elegantly breathing through contractions. And I basically did a full treatment, well, from her head to her feet, in about a half an hour. And then I got called out of the room for a minute to check another patient. I came back, and she was still doing magnificently, and it wasn't but about 2 hours later that she was fully dilated, and she started pushing. And normally, first babies take about 2 hours to push out, but after 45 minutes, without any drugs, without an episiotomy, Maria pushed out a 10-pound, 12-ounce baby.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah. And it was this beautiful, elegant, grown-up birthing room kind of delivery. And after that, I wasn't willing to sneak around anymore, so I offered energy healing to every single patient I took care of in labor and delivery and surgery. And David, it was magic. Women were sleeping at least through the first half of labor when you can't give them any drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them slept until it was time to push with nothing but my hands for pain control. Women were having shorter labors, and my C-section rate went down to only elective repeat C-sections. I was doing like one or two sections a month, and when I was delivering 15 or 20 babies. And the babies were coming out good babies. We weren't seeing distress. These kids were coming out pink and loud and looking like a healthy baby's supposed to look. So that was kind of how things got started in the hospital. And over these last 20 years, I have openly used energy work in first my OBGYN practice, and then for the last nine years, I've been working in the emergency department of small rural hospitals, and I've been openly teaching staff members and offering energy healing to patients there as well.
It's wonderful work. And long, long ago when I was an EMT and I had learned therapeutic touch and a couple of other things, I really, really, really wanted to be able to do it in an emergency room, which was decades before when you started doing it. And I got to do it for like a week in Northern California. But that combination of knowing what you're looking at and being able to offer the energy healing is just amazing.
Well, the advantage that I had, of course, is that as a physician, I didn't have to get anybody in administration's permission.
Right.
Where you would or the nurses would. And over the years, I've spoken in a lot of hospitals and really tried to help people open up more. And it's not the patients or the nurses.
Mm-hmm.
Who are not open to this work. It's administration.
Right, right. Yeah, this was an ER doc that I met, and he snuck me in at 2 o'clock in the morning. He wanted to see what would happen.
Well, when I started working ER, you know, if somebody comes in with back pain or a muscle spasm, you have time to explain things. If somebody comes in shock,
right,
I don't have time to do that. But what I would do, because I always hold people's hands anyhow, so it was no big change, I would hold their hand or have my hand on them while I was examining them, while I was taking a history
right. From
the patient if he or she was conscious, or from the family members if the patient wasn't conscious. And what we were ultimately able to see in some of these situations later was that they could monitor, you know, from blood pressure and vital signs on machines that it would change significantly when I was touching the patient. People
right.
who were in shock after blood loss, I was able to keep their blood pressure up while the staff was getting the IVs and the drugs out of another room so that we could get lines in.
Yep. Hey, we're going to need to go to a break. So we're going to come back in the middle of the story when we get back. I want to make sure people know where to find you online. What's your website?
My website is jerrymillsmd.com.
And it's JERRIMILLS.
MD.com.
So my guest is Jerry Mills, MD, obviously, also a veterinarian and an energy healer. And what an incredible story. We haven't heard the half of it yet. So we will be back shortly, unless, of course, we get taller. And we will continue the story here on the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Don't go nowhere.
I'm home and I love it. I'm home where I belong. I'm home, and I love it, I'm home, where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners, and we want to help you.
I'm home. And I love it, I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home, where I belong.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Sassy! Sassy!
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg. Ha-ha, I win. Whoa! Ah! Sassy! Johnny fell down the well!
I'm wet!
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl! What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold!
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound health and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Come to the forest. It's a place not so far away. A place where you don't have to mow the lawn or babysit.
I saw lizards and squirrels and bugs.
Ladybugs, caterpillars. It's really cool, actually.
A place where you don't have to make time for free time.
Lots and lots of kinds of species here.
Out here, you may even meet the mysterious creature known as the other you. The enchanted you.
It's magic what flowers do.
The adventurous you.
My favorite tree, yes, that one.
The free-to-be-me you. Ask your parents to take you to this not-so-far-away place. Come to the forest, where the other you lives. But first, stop by discovertheforest.org, a public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, Jerry Mills, who is a physician, a veterinarian, and an energy healer. What a combination. And Jerry, you were telling us about labor and delivery and being able to integrate energy healing into your work.
And excuse me. You know, David, as one continues to do energy work, and I would imagine you've had some similar experiences, as soon as you realize something is possible, you can do it, whether you've taken a class or not.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been the case for me. But, of course, Spirit has some little bumps on the road for us and some extra little lessons that we weren't quite expecting. And a bunch of those started coming along after a number of years as well. So I had come to believe that as long as I thought something was possible, I could do it. And I really believed that it was my intent and my belief that drove the whole process. After all, I had a number of patients who thought what I was doing was weird woo-woo stuff. Well, friends who thought it was weird woo-woo stuff, and then their pain would go away when I worked on them. The patients were always a little more believing, probably because I had that title. I can't say the white coat, because I always wore flannel shirts that were color-coordinated with my scrubs when I was on labor and delivery. But, of course, eventually Spirit comes and says, hey, you're getting a little too big for your britches. You think it's you, and you're just the vessel. And she comes and clonks you on the head and teaches you a lesson. So I think the most dramatic of those lessons came to me back about 10 years after I'd started doing energy healing in the hospital. At that point, I was living just outside of Ruidoso, New Mexico. And I had horses, and as well as my dogs and cats at the time. We were living on a little ranch. And there was this lovely man who used to come and trim my horse's hooves. And through a big community potluck that we had every weekend, I'd become friends with him and his wife, as well as a whole lot of neighbors. So this guy, Rip, would come, and over the months, as he came to trim my horse's hooves, suddenly it seemed like he was moving a little more slowly, and his back was a little more bent, and he was spending more time in between each hoof, resting one arm over the horse's shoulder, and just kind of holding himself up and talking, because he just didn't have the energy to mm-hmm. do his job. And he was kind of shriveled and old-looking. I always assumed he was in his 70s. And then one day he came and told me that it was his 60th birthday.
Mm.
So this guy had certainly put in some hard years. But one day I'm sitting at home reading, and I got a phone call from his wife. Now, his wife was a horse trainer, and horse trainers don't call in the middle of the day when it's training season because they're too busy. So right away, I was on the alert, and then I heard this catch in her voice. I said, "Oh, my God, Jamie, what's wrong?" And she started sobbing. She said Rip had been feeling worse and worse over the last few months. He was complaining of some abdominal pain. And finally, the week before, she noticed that the white part of his eyeballs had turned yellow.
Hmm.
And she'd been telling him for months he needed to go to the doctor, but he was a guy. He wasn't going to go. So finally, when his eyeballs turned yellow, she told him that he was either going to the doctor or she was kicking him out of the house. So he went to the doctor. And within a very short period of time, they did some blood work and an ultrasound and immediately sent him down to Alamogordo, which is a large city, a larger city about an hour away, where they had a CAT scanner and could do a little bit more evaluation. And it didn't take but an hour and a look at the CAT scan to realize there was a giant tumor in his pancreas. Now, I think if nothing else from Michael Landon's story, people are all aware of how devastating pancreatic cancer is. And at that point, with his symptoms and with the large mass on the CAT scanner, things were looking pretty bleak for my friend. So the plan had become to send him up to the University Hospital in Albuquerque, where there were cancer specialists who could do some exploratory surgery and possibly a very aggressive surgery if the tumor were localized, so that they could get rid of the cancer and give him some quality of life. But all in all, nobody had a good feeling about this. But I went up to see Rip the day before the surgery, and we sat and chatted for a while, and then, you know, I offered him a healing because that's what mm-hmm. I do. So he laid down on the bed, and I put my hands behind his head, and the energy just poured through me. I was soaking wet, sweating, because there was just so much heat and so much energy pouring through my body. And I did this healing, and the whole time my intent was that Rip would have the emotional strength to get through this ordeal and die in peace, and that the healing energy would help decrease his pain. But my feelings were not, my belief was not the only one in play there. And in truth, what had happened actually over the day or two before that was that Jamie had called all of her friends, and they had put Rip on healing chains at all of their churches. I was in touch with many, many energy healers across the world because it was because they knew me because of my first book, Tapestry of Healing. And we had all been sending energy and prayers to Rip and his wife for several days. So anyhow, I did this surgery. Tell where I come from. I did this healing, gave them hugs, and Jamie promised to call me the next day after his surgery was over and tell me how he was doing. So I'm waiting at home, and it took way, way longer than the doctor had told her to anticipate. But finally, about 8 hours after the operation was supposed to have started, I got a phone call, and Jamie wasn't upset. She sounded kind of happy. I said, "Jamie, my God, what's going on?" She goes, "Oh, the doctor couldn't believe it." She said, he said, "You know, I've been doing these kinds of surgeries as a cancer doctor for 30 years, and I've never seen anything like it." He said he opened up Rip's belly, and it looked like there was cancer that had spread through his whole abdomen. It was in his, there were these lesions in his liver and in the pancreas and in the lymph nodes that he could feel with his hand behind the pancreas. And Jamie said, he looked at me and he said, "You know, if it weren't for protocols, I would have just closed him up and told you to go home and see your priest. But our protocols are that we take biopsies and that we do certain procedures." So I biopsied some of the superficial tumor and sent it down to pathology for frozen sections. And damned if every one of them didn't come back as scar tissue. He said, "Well, it was just bizarre. I didn't believe it. I didn't know what the hell was going on." So I went ahead and I surgically removed all of the lymph nodes that felt like cancer. And I dissected down through his body, and everything that looked abnormal I took out and sent to pathology. And over dozens and dozens of frozen sections, they kept coming back as scar tissue. He says, God, it was the damnedest thing I've ever seen. I've never had anything like this happen in my career. And he says, so I kept dissecting and removing scar tissue, and finally I got to his gallbladder, and there were some stones in it. You know, I decided it must be the most unusual case of gallstones I've ever seen in 30 years, and I'm writing it up for a journal. So there were no biopsies done before the healing, so I can't tell you that it wasn't the most unusual case of gallbladder disease he'd ever seen. But the reality is, that's not what I believe.
Right.
I believe that not me, but me as a focus for all the hundreds of people who were sending energy and healing and prayers to Rip, were able to transmute that tumor.
Yep.
And
yeah, it's... Yeah, so, I do all kinds of work, not so much on people, but a lot of it's land and buildings, but some of it's on people. And every once in a while, you get those things that you sit there shaking your head and going, "Okay, I got medical confirmation before and after." The one I've had bones that were broken one day and weren't the next day. I've had kidney stones were the interesting one.
But, you know, for me, the biggest lesson in this thing wasn't, when hundreds of people send energy, miracles can happen. It was that perhaps my intent and belief were not the driving force of the process, even though I was the healer. And when I went up to visit him a week later, because he was still in the hospital, he looked at me and he grinned and he said, you know, the minute you touched me and I felt that heat, I knew I was going to be fine. And I knew that everything was perfect. And that was when I came to believe that whoever intent and belief is the strongest is what seems to dominate.
Yep. And then, things change because you've shifted the energy so dramatically.
But,
it's amazing
whether it's energy healing, David, or whether it's Western medicine, what I've seen in a 30-year career is the patients who believe that they're going to get well and believe in whatever modality they've chosen are the ones who do the best. You know, there are people who go through chemotherapy and radiation not because they have an intense spiritual belief that it'll work, but because the doctor said to do that, and doctor has the image for them that mommy and daddy had when they were little kids. So it's like, well, that's what I'm supposed to do, so I'm doing it, but I'm scared and I think I'm going to die. Those people die.
Right. And there are also the people who just accept what I call the death sentence. The doctor says you have 6 months to live, and they say, okay, then I guess so, and they go prepare to die, and they die almost to the day.
Well, that's why.
And then there are the people that live another 20 years, and the doctors wonder why.
But no wise physician ever says you have so many weeks to live.
Right, but there are still
those who do, but I think a lot less than there used to be, David. I hope so, anyhow.
Yeah. A friend of mine had a terrible immune system collapse. It's a much longer story, but the medical team came in and basically said, you know, prepare. And she said, I just gave birth to a baby, and there's no way in hell I'm going to die. What you're telling me is you don't have an answer, so you're fired. Get the hell out of my room. I'll find someone with an answer. And that complete sureness that there was an answer and she would find it brought somebody to her that did have the answer.
Yeah.
And this is 25 years later and she's fine.
Yeah.
So,
And when Rip was still fine, the last time I had contact with him was about 5 or 6 years after that, because at some point he moved and we all lost touch with him.
Mm-hmm.
But he was in perfect health still 5 or 6 years later.
Yep. So I want to hear more of your story, because you started out, it sounds like, as a veterinarian before you went to medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very interesting path.
Well, actually, there are plenty of us. But I decided to be a physician when I was 11 years old. And I was in pre-med. But I had a great love for animals. My dad owned a circus. I grew up with best friends that more often had four legs than two. So while I was in undergraduate school, I had I had an Alaskan Malamute, a monkey, and a wolf that I had raised from the time he was a week old, living in my apartment with me. And this was not some hybrid. Alec was a purebred wolf. Mm-hmm. Now, one day I was chatting with my neighbor. I think I was a junior in undergraduate school then. And I was talking to my neighbor, and I said, David, I don't know what I'm going to do when I'm an intern. I can't leave these guys alone all night. Little knowing that both veterinarians and physicians are out all night for their whole careers and not just when they're interns. So anyhow, David looks at me and he goes, well, why don't you be a veterinarian instead? Then you won't have to do that. And I said, oh, okay. So I went to talk to the pre-med advisor at my college, who was the only person in the science department who I did not like. And I told him I was switching from pre-med to pre-vet, and he started laughing at me. And he said, well, I couldn't get into veterinary school. You certainly never will. So that was why I went to vet school. And by the time I graduated, I realized that as much as I loved animals, I still wanted to be a physician. Mm-hmm. So I went back to medical school about 3 years later, started from the beginning all over again, so nobody would ever accuse me of being only a veterinarian who was taking care of them. But I think it made me a much better physician. You know, veterinarians don't have all the fancy equipment that Western medical practitioners have. That MDs have. Mm-hmm. So you really have to learn how to listen and how to do an exam and how to improvise.
And your patients can't tell you the story verbally.
Well, but that's like being a pediatrician. You know, either you mm-hmm. have a good mom who can tell you every time the kid ate or pooped since it was born, or you have a mom who goes, well, he's still alive, so he must be eating.
Yeah, I know a few of those.
Yeah. So it's not what they can tell you, but it's just, and it's learning to think. I believe that because we had to deal with so many species as a veterinarian, it taught me how to think in a way that medical school might not have.
Mm-hmm.
And then it also got my interest in a few other places, like nutrition, because that's a big focus of veterinary medicine. And that led me to have an interest and probably to tend to be more of an integrative medicine doc because I was looking at nutrition as well as drugs. And then later I studied herbal medicine and a little homeopathy, though my focus has always been on various modalities of energy healing. And then whatever workshops I took, I would just basically integrate the work into what I was doing. I don't do a pure reflexology or a pure shamanic journey. I do
right.
a healing and pull in whatever tools I need at the moment. But
right.
that was kind of how it all floated together. And then when I was in medical school, I did my OBGYN rotation in London in a huge teaching hospital. And as is typical in England, all of the normal vaginal deliveries were done by midwives.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to catch a baby, you work with the midwives. And their philosophy was that you have to take care of the patient in order to earn the right to catch the baby. So it got me into a habit of being physically in the room, of taking care of the mother, of helping her. And I'm a hand holder anyhow. So if somebody's scared, you know, I was always holding their hand. And then when I learned meditation breathing, I taught them how to breathe. And as the tools became available to me, I used them. But the fact that I was already in the room talking to my patients, helping them and holding their hands and coaching them made it such a natural transition to integrate energy healing into my OB practice that a lot of people didn't even notice a difference
right.
until I came out of the closet. It was just, well, yeah, Dr. Mills always holds people's hands, and sometimes she does guided imagery. And they, for a long time, those who weren't in my confidence didn't know the difference.
Right, right. Because, yeah.
And then
one of the things about the shamanic work that I do is it's so low drama that people don't notice I'm doing it.
Yeah.
You know, no ritual, no ceremonies, no drums.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, most of it, like you, is going on internally.
Yeah.
So, I totally get it. I don't want to completely leave your comment, that was kind of a side comment, that your family had a circus, because, you know, my family was a circus, but your family owned one.
Yeah, but actually circuses are pretty darn organized entities, or they couldn't bring their whole community together, pack up, and be in a new town every day.
Right. No, I understand that. So, but, you know, that, as soon as you said that, I was just sitting here laughing, going, oh, yeah, my family was, no, wait a minute, she didn't say it was a circus. She said they had a circus. And it actually was a well-known circus. I looked it up.
Yeah, it was. It was, they had it for 27 years until my dad and his brother were both too ill to travel anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the family business. That's pretty amazing. So what's your practice now, and how can people plug into what you do? I know you have your wonderful books.
Thank you. My healing practice is whenever somebody calls me up and asks to do a healing, we set up a time. I prefer working hands-on because I'm just a touchy-feely kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
I do some distance work. I love to teach, and I've taught healing workshops. I've also done a fair amount of lecturing in the past in hospitals, trying to help open people up to the possibility of integrating Eastern healing arts, and more specifically some form of energy healing, into hospitals. And that's something that I love to do, and I think that's part of the reason that I had to be a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Beside the fact that I always wanted to fix everything, from the baby bunnies on the street to my friends when they were hurting. And I grew up in a household where my only understanding of healing was to do it through medicine. So I did both kinds. But those are the work that I like to do the best. In order to keep my dogs fed and a roof over our head, I've been working in little rural hospitals in Minnesota, Louisiana, and Arizona for the last 9 years. But it's also given me the opportunity to introduce energy healing to every community I've ever visited.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really important. And you don't do it by proselytizing. You do it by fixing owies. And after you fix somebody's headache and they tell their friend, then instead of being scary, you become more convenient than looking for the Tylenol.
Right. Right. Yeah. When I talk to skeptics, besides having quantum physics explanations and stuff that are fun, what I always say is, what do you do with the results? I understand that it doesn't make sense to you and you don't think it'll work, but it does work and there are results. So what do you do with that? How do you integrate the fact that something you don't believe can work does work?
Well, I think when people experience it, they just can. And, you know, you think the quantum physics is fun. I understand it. I can talk it when I need to. But what I love best about energy healing is that it's so totally visceral. I don't have to explain stuff. I don't have to do studies. I just have to know that it's so, and it is. I don't have to have a tissue diagnosis in order to be able to help somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that I don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. Getting back to what you were saying about whose intention and whose belief, one of my teachers was trained in the Philippines by psychic surgeons. And he said, you know, I can't go back to the United States and do what you're showing me. And they said, well, that's not what does the healing. The energy does the healing, and you know how to do that. We're just creating a drama so that the person won't switch it back to what they habitually do that caused the problem. And when hypodermic injections with penicillin came to the Philippines, the indigenous psychic surgeons figured out how to touch somebody's arm and make the same pain that the injection made. And that was enough to shift the consciousness, to create the belief. And then they could just do the energy healing and, you know, people would say, oh, Yeah, they're doing their version of what doctors do. It'll work.
Well, you know, David, I don't think our ancestors were stupid, and I don't think we learned what we did for no reason. And I truly believe that sometimes you need a little penicillin, and it's okay.
Yeah, no.
I think what we need to do, and what I try to do in my own practice, and certainly as a teacher and as a consultant, is get people to look at all of the options and use the one that's the least invasive, the wisest, and the most acceptable for a given situation. And, you know, unfortunately, lawyers make us go through protocols sometimes that are not a good thing. And, you know, you can patients have to learn that they have a right to refuse as well. But, God, I'm babbling.
Well, that's what happens on the show. And what happens also is I get the prompt from the producer saying, 4 minutes to close, David. Oh. So we have filled the entire time, and we're just going to have you on again so we can keep the conversation going.
I would love that.
Yeah, I would love to have you on again. My guest tonight is Jerry Mills, physician, veterinarian, and obviously energy healer. And her website is Jerry, J-E-R-I, Mills, MD.com. And Jerry, stay with us when we go off the air so we can chat a couple of minutes.
Okay.
If you've become at all curious about this guy, David, and whatever in the world he does, you can go to househealing.com, and cleverly hiding on the contact tab is every conceivable technology for getting in touch with me, including my schedule. You can make 20-minute free consultation appointment on the phone, and we can talk about what's going on with you and how my work might be helpful. If you would like more information about the show, or you want to listen to or pass along this episode or any of the previous episodes, go to thefarkasfiles.com, and the entire archive is there. We're also on iTunes podcasts, iHeartRadio, and a whole bunch of other online streaming media sources. So just look for empowerradio.com. And thank you so much for listening to the show, wherever you are, whenever you're doing this. It's a real privilege to meet these wonderful people and have wonderful conversations and share them with you. It's a lot of fun. So I don't know if you're on walkabout this week, but I'm certainly on walkabout this week. And stay tuned to yourself and to spirit and enjoy the process and have a wonderful week. So this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic week.